This is the Enterprise Times podcast. My name is Steve Brooks, and today I'm talking to Mark Robinson, more usually known as Robbo, who is co-founder at Kimball Applications. Robbo has led professional services firms for decades and can draw on experiences from both tough and better business climates. While every professional services firm is unique, there are some common challenges and opportunities, and we will discuss some of those learnings. Robbo, welcome back to the podcast. During the pandemic, you relinquished your role as CMO. So what's your role at Kimball now?
Well, thanks, Steve. I think that introduction makes me sound very old. I guess after more than 30 years in professional services industry, then I think it makes anyone feel old. Anyway, seriously, though, to answer your question, I've never been someone who likes job titles full stop. In fact, in my first services firm, which I started back in 1997, believe it or not, which we grew to about 200 people, we didn't have job titles for anyone in the organisation. Because I think sometimes there's a tendency with titles, it's all too easy once somebody has a title to say, that's not my job, that's somebody with that job title's job. And I don't think customers want to hear that. They just want to hear, they want someone to solve their problem. And I found in that business that having no titles made people hold their hand up more often to own stuff, even if it wasn't obviously in their remit. And that worked really well. But I do understand as you get bigger that they become a necessary evil, which is why I've had a job title, which is now co-founder. But to answer your question, in my role as a co-founder at Kimball, being freed from a specific title, it gives me the excuse to get involved anywhere, a bit like I described before, anywhere other people think I can add value as well as myself. Unfortunately, Steve, tends to be in areas I actually enjoy most personally. I'm in a lucky position. So I tend to focus on speaking to leaders in professional services firms across the world. And normally that's face-to-face, particularly in the US, but has been more Zoom-led for obvious reasons. And that way I get the first-hand understanding of the challenges that they face, keep my knowledge up to speed, and then share some of my experiences over, as you said, a very long time to help them solve that. And as part of that, I also evangelize, obviously, Kimball PSA product, and I try and explain where it too can help those challenges. And the final part of my role, and it's probably the part, if I'm honest, I enjoy most, is identifying what I see as talented people and helping them to reach their potential. And it's amazingly rewarding seeing people you spotted when they were very much at the start of their careers and now in senior positions and thinking, I played at least some part in making that happen. And my co-founders are people that I've known from that position, and even Sarah, who heads up Europe. It's been something that I've had a wonderful time watching, and I want to continue watching.
While the nature of the pandemic kind of depression was unprecedented, it wasn't the first time professional services firms have weathered such an inclement business conditions. And it did vary a lot. I realise that. What was the impact?
The first thing we saw was things started to slow down, but there was a lot of ongoing commitments into client projects. To begin with, a lot of our customers, the people I see in the market, thought things wouldn't change. But then what seemed to happen was that the pipeline of work started to dry up, and really it was the backlog being burnt down. And then what we saw was some people laying off some of their contract staff, those people. But generally, people started to sort of batten down the hatches, kept things going. And then gradually, as we saw to the end of last year, things started to pick up again.
Were there any industries more heavily impacted at all?
Certainly anybody that I came across where they had classic retail, hospitality, those sorts of customers as their end client was the impact. Whereas you're seeing some of the others, particularly government, was going the other way. Anybody who had dealing with the NHS or, you know, government organisations where they needed more help was suddenly there. But again, as you said, it's not the first time this has happened before. You know, we've seen this during earlier recessions. You see that situation where things start to slow down. Some companies go to the wall. Certainly growth is slow. But then as we pull out of it, you start to see things pick up. And not only those firms grow, but you see new customers springing up to meet the challenges that are left after whatever that might be. And in this case, as we say, probably a big expansion into the healthcare world as people look to manage in those areas.
As we return to whatever normal business is nowadays, what do you see as the three challenges facing professional services now?
What I'm seeing in the market is that services firms seem to be doing really well, probably since the latter end of last year, early stage of this year. And we've had some record expansion levels. And what I mean by that for us is it's when Kimball customers add new users. And typically, because we sell to services firms, when they add a new user, it means they've hired a new consultant, which is a pretty good anecdotal barometer of the market conditions out there. Anecdotally, the biggest issue seems to be hiring people. There just aren't enough good consultants out there. And as I say, I've always predicted that things would come back like this. As you said in your intro, we've seen it before. We've come out of recession before. And I tend to think from my experience of those previous recessions, what happens as you exit recession is that firstly, there's this pent-up demand. The projects that I talked about that were cancelled or postponed during a recession, or in this case, the pandemic, are then slowly being restarted as things pick up, but everybody's doing it at once, as it were. Then there's, you've got the factor, which is there's a reluctance by customers to hire for certain positions on a permanent basis because of that economic impact. So they bring external consultants in to fill the gap that, as I say, they'd normally fill with permanent people. Thirdly, it's hard to recruit themselves anyway because there's so much competition in the market. It then becomes another reason to look for external consultants to plug the gap. I'd say the first two challenges are people related. They're finding enough people to recruit and holding on to them. And then I'd say the third one is something that isn't new at all. It's just been brought into closer focus, closer view by the speed of the shutdown this time around. And to me, it's bringing greater predictability to your business. It's that feeling of not being able to accurately predict the future in any conditions, not just because of the pandemic. It won't hopefully be another catastrophic event, but it's the challenge that we face anyway in running a services business as we grow. Things like, on practical level, not being able to get accurate financial forecasts, project estimates, or even at a high level where demand is heading skills-wise. When things come to a surprise to you, you end up too often in that firefighting mode, which we talk about a lot, where you're reactively jumping from fire to fire to try and fix one unexpected problem after another.
I'll come back to that predictability bit, but in terms of those first two, is there something businesses should do or could do differently than they've maybe done before about looking at hiring people? Should they be looking at hiring apprentices? Should be looking at increasing their training to rapidly upskill people?
It's actually a number of those things. I think it's a great place to be if you're a younger person for once. People having to go and not just say, well, I'm not going to expect any new graduates. I'm going to wait for somebody who's got 2 years experience, or people haven't even got a degree. They've got to start being more clever about that, being a bit more flexible than they have been, where they've had been more fortunate in the past in terms of supply and demand mix. In terms of your own organisation, in terms of people, then it's about continuing to demonstrate to your own team to retain them that you care about their career. If you do that, then other people get to hear about it. It's tempting when you've got kind of a boom market to put people onto long projects with the benefits of high utilization and therefore getting, you know, great profitability. And that might be good for you in the short term, but it's not good for them or for you in the long term. And I always used to say in my 2 consulting businesses that I owned, you aren't adding at least a line to your CV several times a year or at least once a year, you should probably leave. By telling them that openly, it kept them on their toes. Kept us on our toes to find them interesting challenges within our organization rather than letting them stagnate and therefore them sort of looking outside. And I do also think people tend to think that the big firms are really good at this compared to smaller firms, but I actually think it's the other way around a lot of the time. And I can think of a really good example where I had a consultant leave me to join one of the big firms because he wanted to change a role from the customer he was on. And actually, when he joined the big five, all they did was put him straight back on the same project because the client whinged and now he's working somewhere else. Obviously, they're charging him at a higher rate. A few months later, once he sort of smelt the coffee, he got the reality of this in the bigger firm. He wanted to come back. We said, yeah, absolutely, come back. You can imagine that was fantastic morale. That people understood the grass isn't always greener.
What about diversity? Because obviously, diversity is a hot topic. How do business leaders need to introduce more diversity into the firm? Because it's talked about a lot, but it's not always delivered successfully, is it?
I can remember when I ran my consulting firms, one of the things we did was recruit graduates. And the traditional area in IT services was to recruit graduates who come from a science background, for example. We deliberately went out there to get people who had come from an arts background, any background in sense, coming into the organization. And we had pretty extensive recruitment program around the graduate program. All we did was we did a classic aptitude test because we had to know some level of knowledge for the logical side of life. We did lots of presentation skills, the sort of things they'd really be doing as consultants. That ended up bringing a load of candidates in who'd never end up going to IT services, but had come from a non-scientific background in the industry. And we had a fantastic set of people that I know, because a long time ago, have all gone on to have fantastic, successful careers in our industry.
If you're not diverse, it's hard to become diverse. If you're already diverse, it is actually very easy to remain being diverse.
About 20 years ago, I met the chairman of Inchcape. I played golf with him for some reason. He was a customer of ours. And at the end of the day, he bought us dinner. Regaled the story. He grew up as a T-boy at Rover before running this hugely successful public floating company. He said that when he arrived in the management leadership team, they all had different colour carpets and different furniture depending on their grades and that kind of stuff. It was that old, very stuffy, old-fashioned place. He sat in his first board meeting. Everybody was 40-plus white, and they're running the global business, middle-aged white men. And so he deliberately promoted a guy who was in the Hong Kong office who was an Asian guy onto the board. And he freely admitted the guy wasn't probably worthy, as it were, to be on the board. But he decided that would be a role model for other people to say you don't have to be a white male English guy to be on the board. Inchcape was hugely successful. And that's going about 20 odd years ago. So I was just sat there, you know, my jaw hanging out, thinking what an amazing guy when I was listening to him. I remember that story very often when I'm sitting in meetings thinking, God, I got to think differently here. He did it 20 years ago.
You mentioned predictability. How can companies get more predictability into their business?
The first thing is, in terms of predictability, is I see too many firms focusing, looking backwards rather than forwards when operating their business. I talked the cliche before, but you know, looking through the rearview mirror rather than the windscreen, so to speak. And they spend money, I think, on systems and processes which tell you how you perform historically. Now, that's the real focus. Is not enough effort onto how you drive more accurate forecasts. It's a systems of record versus system engagement stuff that Geoffrey Moore always talks about. You need to prioritize having effective systems engagement to help people make those kind of informed, accurate and timely decisions, the sort of decisions that actually do impact your future business performance rather than worrying about history. And it's not just at the detailed level like budgets and targets and project estimates. It can be at a high level too. One of the pieces of advice I give to people is to formalize, for example, a regular review at the highest level of what skills are hot and which are not, because things do change. What are the market trends you're seeing? What do you need to be prepared for? It's all too easy in my experience to, especially when things are going really well, when it's really booming, not to notice that there's been just a slight decline in certain areas and looking at the forecast, while other areas are kind of starting to grow that maybe you haven't got the right people for. So you need to be tuned into those changes in demand and make sure you get the right mix in the firm. And I think people often forget that. If you aren't forecasting accurately, then however good your execution is, you're fighting a losing battle or you never get to put out the fires that we talked about before. And the other thing I mentioned in terms of improving predictability, I've been into doing a lot of research lately, trying to understand a lot more about cognitive bias and how that impacts your organization. I'm sure you've come across the work of Nobel Prize winner Danny Kahneman, who's the kind of godfather of behavior economics. What he looks at is why we make the sort of judgments, the decisions we make in our professional lives and what's behind it. If you understand that, it really helps you to get predictability. And very often we don't realize how many of the decisions we make, like estimating a project, are kind of unconsciously being impacted by our brain's natural attempt to simplify the processing information. I've just been reading actually his latest book called Noise. I don't know if you've got to that yet. And it's got some pretty startling findings on the variability there is in those professional judgments. And one of the examples relevant to this audience is that he found that while we think there's roughly 10% variability between what different people say and say estimating in a professional organization, in practice, the average is around 55%. In the case of a software development team, he found it was 71%. So we kid ourselves that we don't have this sort of variability, but it does. So I would say to improve predictability, you really need to spend time making sure that you aren't unconsciously getting your predictions wrong because of cognitive bias in its various forms. You know, that's well worth the effort.
Moving on, as we're emerging from pandemic, how are professional services firms changing, or where do you see the main changes are at the moment?
The biggest change when you read or listen to people, they would have you believe, is it's all about working remotely. Before the pandemic, if you're running a global project, then by necessity, you had to include some meetings online, quite a lot, I suspect. I think most of the services firms have shifted to 100% delivery online. And there's been a lot of predictions, as I say, where people say that shift is irrevocable. We're never going back. But I personally disagree with that. Very recently, I've been speaking to quite a few of our customers, professional services firms, and they're starting to intentionally move people back to more of an on-site model, at least part of the time, because you've got this skills problem. The best way of developing skills of consultants, and particularly, as we talked about, the less experienced ones, the ones you need to bring in from diverse backgrounds, diverse skill sets. And that's really important. At the moment, there's no substitute for learning you're going to get working closely with someone. Those ad hoc interactions you get, the osmosis, is really the most powerful way. Certainly I learned in my lifetime from the people around me, and that's very difficult to do on a Zoom call. But I do think, though, that the fundamental impact that's going to happen for the pandemic is just something that's happened before. It's accelerated the change that we were already seeing. It's just happened, as I say, a lot faster. It's traditionally that a consultant's lot, particularly at the early stage of your career, has been serving your time working often ridiculous hours with lots of travel, short notice. Before you progress up that chain of command, then you get others to do that for you. What I'm seeing is that young consultants, the newer consultants of today, are not willing to do that. They want a better work-life balance from the get-go. And they're actually maybe helped by the shortage of labour. They're prepared to move to firms much more quickly who can offer that, or even move out of consulting altogether. It's something the industry needs to start preparing for. And I'm just seeing people waking up to that.
Another area as ex-CMO, as we emerge from the lockdown, how important is marketing as firms, both the new startups and old, strive for attention in what is quite a busy market?
Marketing is obviously close to my heart. It's an area that I think even before lockdown and the pandemic, a lot of services firms didn't focus on enough. I was always finding that. Even though my job has meant that I'm targeting professional services firms, I'm always still amazed at how many quite reasonably sized firms I've never come across. It never got their name out there. It's a good question to ask people to name all the consulting companies they know, and it's amazing how few they know. My theory is that that's because there's general expectation that success of any marketing initiative, you know, any spend you do, is only measured by the number of leads you get immediately out of it. I remember speaking to one sort of 1,000-plus person IT services firm who told me that they gave up on doing webinars, for example, as they tried it and they didn't get any leads from it after the webinar. And I explained to them, you know, for me, marketing in professional services is all about making as many people understand what you're famous for. It's about what your brand's about, making people understand what are the problems that you're, maybe hopefully you're saying, uniquely placed you can solve, or at least one of the companies you can solve it. And I think you need to be confident that if you do that kind of effort at some stage in the future, when someone is looking for someone to solve a particular problem, that they think of you and they put you on the tender list. You might be lucky when it happens a week after your marketing push, but I think it's more likely to be some considerable amount of time later. It's going to be difficult, to be honest, to measure the cause and effect directly from that. But if you aren't on the tender list, then you don't know whether you would have won it. So for me, it's all about being clear what your value proposition is, what you want to be famous for, as I call it. Marketing the proverbial out of that to establish and reinforce your credibility and trust that by doing that, you'll be rewarded at some stage in the future.
You've talked about talent, you've talked about culture, you've talked about marketing, you've talked about revenue. What should the business leader's top three priorities be?
It's probably no surprise that from what I've been saying earlier, that investing in people is really important. It's all too easy when you're resource constrained to neglect that. When a client says, I really don't want you to take that person off the project because you want them to do some training, you need to stand up to them and try and explain to them why that's important for that person. You need to trust that that will give you, might give you some short-term gain with some extra utilization, but it actually will cost you more in the future. The second one I'd say is cutting out the red tape. And I've seen this particularly as firms grow. I've seen a lot of informal processes inadvertently spring up over time, the sort of processes which slow down decision-making. When you were smaller, it's okay that a small number of people made all the big decisions. But as you get larger, that does create bottlenecks, you know, even inadvertently. One thing the pandemic has taught a lot of people is you don't need to see someone all day long face to face to make sure they're actually doing their job. And you should use the lessons from that kind of enforced working from home to empower people to make more sense of their decisions. In my experience, people at the coalface, so to speak, are always in a much better position to make judgments. So you should trust them. And then to help this happen, my third priority would be to take a long, hard look at the metrics that you use to run your business. Many of the people I meet have tens or hundreds of KPIs that they measure. But when you challenge them, I find that very few actually look at them regularly. That often frustrates the employees. That's the trickle-down effect. The same employees you want to empower are tied up collecting data that they've no idea why it's being collected, and they struggle with that. And it certainly isn't really helping them or anyone else make better decisions. I use the term measure what matters. To come up with what really matters, a simple rule of thumb I always say to people is that if you don't look at KPI daily, or at the very least weekly, then get rid of it. Focus on the metrics which really influence how you run your business. So for a PS firm, for example, that would be something like gross margin variance. So you're understanding where you're tracking against project profitability. That's a real one that you should be looking at every day.
Looking forward, while the next major recession may be some time away, how should firms prepare for such an event? Should they be wary of how further lockdowns might impact their business?
I started my first two professional services firms during recessions as we were coming out of them. And it may seem counterintuitive, but I think actually that's the best time to do it, because I think it really focuses the mind on what are the key problems out in the market you're going for, and what skills and what level of experience you're going to need in your firm to address them and be really finely tuned to that. And then I think when markets boom, there's a tendency to rush to take advantage of the demand when a new area comes up, like a Salesforce skills maybe 10 years ago. I've seen firms overexpand by lowering the quality standard in their recruitment, and they tend to invest less in training their team because those demand levels means they can get them out billing faster than they could normally. And they can put them on projects maybe where they don't have all the right skills. They can get away with it, so to speak. But then what happens is when the next recession hits and the demand starts to fall, they're left with people who don't have the right skills and right balance of experience for the market. Then you get a lot of influx of people on the bench. As you know, Steve, in a consulting company, you can burn a lot of cash very quickly when you've got people on the bench. I've seen several firms fail completely or at least never fully recover from it. The firms that grew on the back of boom markets and didn't keep the quality up struggled once the pandemic hit, naming no names. But the ones who had really good people and methods and management teams are now actually in a fantastic position because they're at the right place at the right time. So my advice is to make sure you stay tuned to the market. Make sure you continue to invest in your people. Don't lower your standards, however tempting it might be to bring people on board more quickly.
Is the one thing business leaders should do or that they need to do differently as opposed to pre-pandemic?
I think no, actually. I think that's one of the key things I've been trying to talk about here. Is it, to run a professional services firm, in fact, I think any type of firm comes down to people, process and technology. And I think that was the same before 2019 and it'll stay the same way for probably as long as I'm working. That might come odd from somebody who's running a technology business, but too often I think actually people run to technology first to try and fix a problem. Too much of the problems we generally have, we tend to blame people for, when the real culprit we should be looking at is the bad processes that cause them to make errors of judgments. I talked about with people like Kahneman. Many of the people I meet in my travels are in fast-growing organizations, but many of them are still operating the same processes they had when they were much smaller. So I think focus on getting the processes right. And when we have the process right, the guardrails within which they should operate, we can then apply the technology as it should be used to help govern those processes and let people operate more effectively in an empowered way. And I think that was true before 2019, and it's going to be true for some time to come.
It's been a pleasure. Always enthralling. Thank you very much.
Thank you.